Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Risk Distance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Thomas Lindsay. He's the executive director and an attorney for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which has assisted close to 200 communities across the country in 8 states to adopt binding local laws that elevate community rights to sustainability over corporate rights and powers. So first, thank you, of course, for your great work, and also thank you for being on the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, Derek.
So you have a new film out or soon to be out. So can you tell us about the film?
Sure. So it's been a long time coming, but for the past 4.5 years, we've been working with a production company out of California called Tree Media Company. And Tree Media are the folks that did The 11th Hour with Leonardo DiCaprio, the movie that dealt with global climate change. And they're also the production company that's been working with DiCaprio to put out some short films on environmental issues. They approached us about 5 years ago and wanted to essentially tell the story of the communities who have become part of what's become known as the community rights movement in the United States. And essentially, they've been embedded with the communities that we've been working with over the past 5 years and have gotten footage and done interviews with folks in Colorado and Oregon, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Ohio, different places where this work has really, really been grounded. We just learned the other day that the Seattle International Film Festival has selected the documentary that they've produced for their film festival in June. And that they've also entered it into the competition, the documentary competition. So we'll see how well it does against some of the other documentaries that have been selected for that festival. But all to say, we're very excited. It's the first film. It's going to be about an hour and a half long. It's the first video production that really takes a comprehensive look at what these communities are doing. And so, for example, they talk with our folks in Pittsburgh, the city of Pittsburgh. We helped to become the first major municipality in the United States to ban oil and gas drilling within city boundaries. And the city council also passed, as part of that law on fracking and oil and gas drilling, a provision that stripped oil and gas corporations of certain legal rights within the city of Pittsburgh. And also recognize that the rivers that run through the city of Pittsburgh, the ecosystems themselves, have legally enforceable rights. And so telling that story, those stories of fairly complex lawmaking that communities have undertaken and compressing it down into an hour and a half of understandable film has been the challenge, really, in working over the past 4.5 years with these particular filmmakers. The Seattle Film Festival is going to show the film June 10th and 11th, and there's going to be a premiere of the film in Los Angeles probably sometime over the summer, and an official release date hasn't been set, but we're probably looking at late summer, early fall. So we're very excited, and we also have a book coming out as a companion to the movie. The movie is called We the People 2.0. And the book is called We the People 2.0, Stories from the Community Rights Movement. And so the book is being used essentially to do some further interviews and introduce more and more people to what's happening in these communities, and to use it as a parallel to the film coming out as well. So it's all very exciting to us, and it's all new to us because we don't really live in that world of film production. But we're hoping to use the film as an organizing tool for communities to learn more about what these other places have done, and as they attempt to replicate what's happened in those communities themselves.
So you've mentioned several times what the communities are doing, replicating what they're doing. And can you be very specific about what – presume that somebody doesn't know anything about your work, and what are the communities doing? What's the problem, and how are the communities trying to solve whatever this problem is?
Sure. So communities across the United States for the past 70 years, when they've been faced with specific problems like toxic waste landfill coming in, or a toxic waste incinerator, or a hog factory farm, or dumping of sewage sludge, basically any of the hundreds of different single issues that communities are faced with every day in the United States that are usually driven by a corporation or an association of corporations that are seeking to put those projects into those communities. That many times the communities don't want those things in their neighborhoods or in their municipalities. And so, you know, I wouldn't particularly want a 15,000 head hog factory farm in the middle of my community or next door to me. And over the past 7 years,
just a sec, you know, my mom just asked me this last night. You know, I live on land that we just love the forest here. And she was saying, so, you know, they can frack. We own the land, but almost everywhere, many, many places, fracking, they can take what's below your land without, even though you still own the land. And she was saying, what would you do if they came in here and said, we're going to frack beneath your land and we're going to cut all the trees on this land? What would you do? And so I'm just saying that in terms of a tangible example of exactly what you're talking about. This happens all over.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people have no clue about whether they own their own mineral rights, for example. So you could own the deed for your surface land, but your mineral rights could have been sold, you know, many years ago. And then a company comes in to actually frack your land. And in many places, they don't, and this sounds crazy, but it's true, that in many places, they don't even need to have title to your mineral rights to actually take the oil and gas from underneath your property. In other words, even if you own the mineral rights, a number of states have passed laws that allow them, that compel the property owner to actually sell those, in this case, oil and gas rights underneath the land that they own on their property. So in many ways, you know, the right of the corporations to access these resources is pretty much untrammeled and unlimited. So even in a case where you even own your own mineral rights, there's no guarantee that you're going to be able to keep those from getting drilled or taken from you. And so, you know, not only oil and gas drilling, but all these other problems, you know, factory farms, corporate water withdrawals like Nestle coming in and sucking an aquifer dry, like they're attempting to do in a small town in Pennsylvania and across the U.S. in a bunch of different communities, that for the past 70 years, if you're in one of those communities and you think that one of those projects is going to be harmful to you, you've essentially been given mostly one option at that point for your activism, for your attempt to stop that project from happening. And that one option has been to argue with the regulatory agency whose responsibility it is to issue the permit to the corporation to do that particular project. And when you engage in that particular argument, when you engage in that particular avenue of activism, you're basically pointed to a regulatory agency that has the responsibility for issuing that particular permit to that particular corporation, and then arguing somehow that the corporation never should have gotten the permit because the permit application that they submitted to the regulatory agency was somehow deficient, that it didn't contain what it needed to contain, didn't have the right bond amount, wasn't signed by the right person, didn't have the right hydro study in it, those types of things. And that's what environmental lawyers have done for the past 40 years, is try to pick apart these environmental permit applications that have been submitted by those companies. The problem, of course, is that when you get to that point that you're faced with one of those corporate projects coming in, that essentially that regulatory system, the regulations that you're attempting to use to stop the project in the first place, were essentially written by the very corporations that ostensibly those regulations are supposed to regulate. So when you're fighting a factory farm in Pennsylvania, you run up against environmental regulations that were written by the very agribusiness corporations that are then using those regulations to jam that factory farm into your community, that unwanted use that your community doesn't want. And so it's almost like, you know, you're playing baseball, but you're inserted in the eighth inning at, you know, at the bottom of the eighth inning when the score is already 394-2. And you're being asked to fight a project under scripted rules that were written by someone else other than your community. And if you're a corporation in one of these industries, there's no incentive for you to write a regulatory framework that actually gives the community any kind of power or authority whatsoever to stop your project. Because after all, if you're the ones writing the script, why would you give any power or authority whatsoever to the community that's on the receiving end of the project that's going to make you money? It doesn't make any sense. But it's under that delusion that almost all of our environmental activism has been done over the past 40 years, which is this is what environmental lawyers do. They take the pre-written environmental regulations that are in place that are written by someone else, and then we attempt to enforce them. And it's no wonder that after, you know, 40 years after the major environmental law has been passed, that by almost every major environmental statistic, things are worse now today than they were before those environmental laws were passed. And so on a long way around here to describe what we do, we've basically rejected that model. We're half environmental law firm and half community organizers. But we've assisted communities to actually begin to adopt local laws that reflect what they want for their community, not what they can get under the existing system, which is very, very, very limited under that regulatory scheme of activism, but instead to turn their backs on that, not waste their time with it, not waste their time, energy, or resources with a system that's inevitably going to give them a factory farm or a frack job or a toxic waste incinerator anyway. It might give them a better toxic waste incinerator with a slightly better setbacks and maybe taller fences, but they're still going to get it in their community. And so starting about 12 years ago, we began working with communities to do something different. And that was to seize their municipality, their city, their town, their village, their county, and actually seize it to begin making laws that ban those projects from coming into those communities. And today they look fairly similar across, you know, it started out a very basic place, but has now evolved to a more complex one. But the laws all have common denominators. The first is that they contain a community bill of rights. So people at the community level believe that they have a right to clean air and clean water. They're shocked when they discover that their state governmental system doesn't recognize their right to clean air or clean water or a sustainable energy system. And so they've begun writing those rights into what are called local bills of rights within their own community. So to be practical, the city of Pittsburgh unanimously through the city council adopted a community bill of rights that recognizes a legally enforceable right for the residents of the city of Pittsburgh to clean air and clean water and a sustainable energy future. The local laws then ban those activities, like fracking, that violate the rights set out within the local Bill of Rights within those laws. And then they go two steps further, which is to say, over the last 50 years, the reason why communities haven't passed these kinds of laws is because they've been punished for doing so. We have a system of law that actually punishes them for attempting to stop these harmful projects from coming into their community.
In your film, you say, or somebody says, that sustainability is illegal.
Yes, very much so. Because communities who have an interest in sustainability have one set of rights. The corporation that's coming in to actually impose an unsustainable project on the community has another set of rights. And the legal system that we have today actually privileges the corporation's rights above the rights of the community. So that's why we have the regulatory system, which essentially bolsters the right of the corporation to put the project in. I mean, in very short language, we have a system in which corporations have more rights than the communities in which they're attempting to do business. And so, you know, the two steps further, in addition to the Bill of Rights and then prohibiting those activities or projects that violate those rights, is that these communities have gone two steps further to understand that they will be punished for adopting these kinds of laws, even though the laws are about protecting the health, safety, and welfare of their own communities, that there are various tools out there that corporations have to punish communities who pass those kinds of laws. And one of those things that happens to punish those communities is corporations sue them. So Corporation A comes in to sue Community A for stopping them from withdrawing water from the aquifer within the community, for example. And when the corporation comes in, they got a lot of tools that they can use to sue the community. And one of the biggest set of tools is called corporate rights. So corporations have constitutional rights under our system of law. And those constitutional rights include things like a right against having their property taken without being paid for that takings. under the system of law, unfortunately, a permit that's been issued to the corporation to put in, for example, a water bottling operation. That permit is actually treated as property under the law. So when a community bans the water withdrawal operation, the law sees it as taking property from the corporation because it interferes with their permit that the corporation holds to put the specific project into that community. So the corporation comes in and says to the community, well, you owe us now $5 million or $50 million or $500 million because you've stopped us from putting in this project within our community. And so therefore, you violated our corporate rights and you owe us money. And to make the situation even worse, they can sue the community not only for those damages that are suffered, so money from the community, but can also sue them for attorney's fees. So all the attorney's fees that the corporation runs up in suing the community, they then ask the judge to assess the community those attorney's fees as well. And they're not limited just to corporate rights when they sue. They can also sue the community under preemption. In other words, the state usually has a set of laws in place that actually preempts communities from passing laws banning corporate water bottling operations or factory farms or sewage sludge or fracking or whatever.
Like, I think a headline that I saw in the film, too, is Texas outlaws outlawing fracking.
Yes. Preemption laws are pretty common, especially in the oil and gas field. But what that article refers to is the city of Denton. People within the city of Denton, Texas, took the extraordinary step, at least within Texas, of attempting to ban oil and gas extraction, fracking, within the city of Denton. And 48 hours after they passed that, they were sued twice, once by the corporations that were attempting to frack within Denton, but also by the state. So the state of Texas stepped in to actually sue the municipality for violating the oil and gas laws at the state level. Because the oil and gas laws at the state level, whether it's Texas or Colorado or wherever else, Pennsylvania, contain a provision that outlaws localities from being able to adopt anything more stringent than what the state has put into place via the state oil and gas laws. So it's similar to what happened in Charlotte recently in North Carolina, you know, switching gears from environmental to civil rights when the state passed House Bill 2, which essentially outlawed cities within the state of North Carolina from passing more expansive anti-discrimination laws than what the state has in place. And so the power exercised is the same, whether it's the oil and gas industry or whether it's the legislators in North Carolina on the anti-discrimination stuff, is that there is a power at the state level to preempt, which essentially means nullifying an entire area of law, to say to the localities, you can't pass X. The dangerous thing about that in the oil and gas field and the environmental field is that when a state passes a law that preempts the communities from banning a certain use, that the corporation can come in because that preemptive law is privately enforceable. So it doesn't necessarily have to be the state that comes in to say to the locality, you can't do X. The corporation can actually sue the municipality saying you can't do X because the state has passed this law that says you can't do X. And so all to say, there's a whole menu available for corporations when corporations come in to sue the municipalities. But the interesting thing about it is over the past 12 years of us doing the work, it's basically a script. I mean, you don't have to be a brain surgeon to be a corporate lawyer, because all these lawsuits are the same. They rely on the same legal theories. They rely on the same corporate rights stuff. It's pretty easy to be a corporate lawyer because everything's boilerplated on your computer screen. All you do is customize it for the individual lawsuits that you have to do against these communities. And so the communities that we've worked with, including the city of Pittsburgh and the close to 200 others, understanding that that toolkit is available to the corporations that they can try to use to pry those communities apart, have embedded in their local lawmaking two big challenges to that preemptive strike. In other words, they're putting stuff into their laws that preemptively attempt to get at that stuff that they know they're going to face a couple months down the road or a couple years down the road if one of these lawsuits is brought. And one is a refusal to recognize corporate rights. In other words, these laws actually strip corporations of what's generally been accepted as their corporate constitutional rights and powers under the law. Because these communities have said, wait a minute, you know, if we pass this and we get sued and this thing gets overturned, then what's the point? And have begun, you know, 12 years ago to say to themselves, we need to go deeper. we actually need to go deeper and get at the structural stuff so that we're in the best defensible position later if the corporation comes in and attempts to sue us. And so they've actually passed laws, these 200 communities, that strip corporations of certain constitutional rights and powers within their municipality. And in addition to that, they've begun to understand that the problem is not the corporation. And that may sound funny, because when communities get hit with these projects, the first thing that appears in their community is generally a company who's attempting to put a project into their community. But the problem is that the corporations don't have the right to put those projects into those communities without governmental backing. In other words, corporations and their constitutional rights didn't appear out of nowhere. They actually have been concocted and bestowed by the federal and state court system. And in addition, corporations are chartered by our own governments. So their creation is dependent upon our governmental system. And so in these local laws that communities have passed, they not only go after the corporation, they go after the state. And they say specifically that all state laws or permits or licenses are nullified if they run counter to the Bill of Rights that have been passed by the local community. So in some ways, it's a nullification of state law that's backing the corporation to come into the community, because the community understands that preemption and other state legal doctrines can be used against them down the road if they ban this specific use within their community. And the final topper for these local laws, as they've developed over the past decade or so, has been something called rights of nature, which is that in the United States today, ecosystems and natural communities are not considered to be rights-bearing. So a stream, for example, has no rights, as we understand rights to be, or a forest has no rights, or a community of cougars has no rights, or an ecosystem in general has no rights. And because of that, the system in the United States has developed to a point where if you're rich enough to own multiple ecosystems, in other words, the more land and property you can own, the more legal right you have to destroy more ecosystems and property in the United States. And so the more wealth you have, the more ecosystems you can destroy. So we have a property-based system of environmental protection in the United States, which hasn't worked out particularly well. Because now every major ecosystem is in decline. And so these communities have moved forward to do something extraordinary, which is to recognize that ecosystems have legally enforceable rights within their communities. So as amazing as it is to sit here and say today, the city of Pittsburgh unanimously through their city council adopted a rights of nature ordinance that recognizes that the rivers, the Monongahela and the Allegheny, the other waterways within the city of Pittsburgh actually have binding enforceable legal rights of their own that the community can stand in the shoes of to actually defend those ecosystems against these corporate harms coming in. So I think, all to say, just to pull that all together, is that the community rights movement is really a movement towards self-determination of communities, when communities are defined not just as human communities, but also natural communities, that rivers have a right to exist and flourish and actually self-determine. And I don't think we're used to using the word self-determine in that capacity, but I think that's what we're seeing is this movement is about redefining what a community is outside of just the two-legged homo sapiens and actually moving to a point where we're talking about self-determination, not just for humans that live in a particular area, but also about natural systems and ecosystems having that right to self-determine as well.
So we have – I know that in Spokane there was a rights of nature when you have the people try to put it on the ballot.
Mm-hmm. Initiative,
thank you. You had an initiative that was very, very narrowly defeated a couple years ago, but let's pretend it passed. So Spokane now recognizes the rights of nature, and let's say they also ban fracking within the city, or Pittsburgh bans fracking. Mm-hmm. So that's all nice that the city and you and a bunch of let's just call them busybodies, okay? go ahead and make these declarations, but ultimately, who cares? Because there's this thing called the Commerce Clause, and there's also, can't the feds just sort of pat you on the head and say, that's a very nice little boy, but when you grow up, you're going to understand how the system really works?
Well, of course. I mean, that's what happens with the laws that have been passed in different places when they get challenged, is that the corporations say, well, that's very nice, but that's not the law. And we're asking the judge to uphold what the law really is. And so what you get is a confrontation, which is in some ways the point of the organizing. It's not, you know, for us over the past decade or so in pioneering some of this work, you know, people ask, well, what's the point? And sometimes we say, well, what was the point of the four African-American kids who sat down at the lunch counter at Woolworths? You know, the fact is there's a moral and ethical need to do something, but there's also an understanding that if enough places do it, that eventually you begin to force change into higher levels of government. And you're starting to see that now in different places, including Oregon and Ohio, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, places where we've dug down and begun to do that grassroots kind of work. But in some places like Ohio, we have a dozen communities now that have moved forward to pass and propose new community rights initiatives who are now coming together at the state level to drive state constitutional changes that would actually legalize communities moving forward to ban certain projects at that level. But returning back to Spokane on the Spokane River issue, the initiative that almost passed, which is amazing in itself for anyone that knows the city of Spokane.
It's very conservative.
That initiative that almost passed was a result of 4 years of organizing to bring organized labor to the same table as environmental organizations, to the same table as neighborhood activists, who sat down and did a 3-year visioning process and eventually decided to support each other's initiatives. So the labor folks wanted to recognize constitutional rights in the workplace, and the environmental groups wanted to recognize the rights of the Spokane River, and the neighborhood activists wanted to recognize the right of neighborhoods to say no to big box stores. And all three of the entities arrived at the conclusion that to get anything that they wanted, they also needed to deprive or strip corporations of certain constitutional rights in Spokane that would otherwise interfere with constitutional rights for workers in the workplace, neighborhoods saying no to big box stores, and the river having certain rights within the city of Spokane. Amazingly, they all came together and agreed on a common initiative, which had four planks, which contained those four things. So you had the labor folks voting to support the rights of the Spokane River, and you had the environmental groups voting to support the rights of workers in the workplace to have constitutional rights. And those entities voted to support neighborhoods having the right to say no to big box stores. All to say is that there was a cultural change that started to happen in Spokane, driven by those groups who actually came to common agreement on that particular Bill of Rights. For the Spokane River to have rights, you're talking about a change in the entire legal system, the way that the legal system and law treats ecosystems and natural communities. And I think the best example of the furthest that's moved has been Ecuador, where in 2008, the people of Ecuador decided to adopt a new constitution that had the rights of nature embedded within it. So we traveled to Ecuador. The Ecuadorians learned about what was happening in the United States around rights of nature stuff. And the people of Ecuador in 2008, by a large margin, ratified a new national constitution, which in many ways shifted the country of Ecuador from a property-based environmental protection system to a rights-based system of environmental protection. Recognizing that ecosystems within the country of Ecuador had certain rights to exist, flourish, and naturally evolve was the phrase that was used within that particular piece of legislation, that new constitution. And since then, you've had cases. You've had actual litigation using that constitutional amendment language to bring cases. What do those cases look like? Well, they have the ecosystem as a plaintiff. So one of the first enforcement cases brought is now known as the Vilcabamba River versus the province of Loja. So the local government in Ecuador, the province of Loja, was dumping debris from a road building project into the river, thus altering the Vilcabamba River's flow and its course. and people living next to the river brought a lawsuit. And when nature has rights, the plaintiff is no longer the person that's been affected by a specific activity, but the ecosystem itself. So it's a much different kind of posture for a case than what we're used to seeing in the courts. And in that case, the court became the first court in the world ever to actually rule in favor of the ecosystem. So rule in favor of the river and then order the local government to actually compensate the river by actually fixing the problem. And there's been other cases in Ecuador at this point about illegal gold mining. There was attempts to use the constitutional provisions around shark fin fishing and other environmental issues. But suffice it to say, currently today, ecosystems have no standing in a court. So when an ecosystem is affected, the only entity that has standing are the people, you know, or companies that are affected by what's happened to the environment. But the environment doesn't exist. Just like slaves didn't exist in the courtroom in the 1840s, women didn't exist in the courtroom in the 1870s, that the system of law did not recognize them and did not see them. They were invisible for purposes of the courts. That today ecosystems are invisible to those court systems. And a lot of what communities are doing right now is attempting to make them visible. And in a very practical sense, and I'll end, you know, quit talking with this one, but we have a case running currently in federal court where a community in Pennsylvania called Grant Township, a small community in central Pennsylvania, about 700 people, passed a law banning frack wastewater injection wells. So there's a plan in Pennsylvania to build about a dozen injection wells, which is where all the brine and nasty toxic stuff from fracking gets disposed of, basically just dumped in a hole and operated for 10 years and then covered over. And 60% of all those wells leak. So it's a threat to everything, including groundwater and quality of life and everything else. So a community banned a frack wastewater injection well. They were sued by a company called Pennsylvania General Energy. Came in, sued them in federal court, sued them for damages, sued them to overturn the ordinance, because the law that had been passed by Grant Township had a rights of nature provision in it. What you saw next was the actual watershed, the ecosystem that would be affected by the frack wastewater injection well, represented by one of our lawyers who made a motion to intervene in the case. So you had an ecosystem making a motion to intervene in litigation that would affect the health of the ecosystem. And in addition to making news, which, you know, of course, is always good because people learn about a new approach and it begins to expand their frame. But the fact is that the defense of these communities has to involve more than just the community of people. It's actually got to begin to put forward what the best interests of and the rights of the ecosystems are within those communities as well. Otherwise, we think it's an incomplete movement just to have people beginning to press against those edges of the law, but that the law needs to change and that these communities are the first ones on the front lines who are beginning to force that change to happen. So I have to tell you on an emotional side, when you pull up the court docket sheet, which is where all the lawyers file because everything's done electronically today, and actually to see the watershed and to see the ecosystem as a listed party, it does something to the brain. And I don't know quite what it is, but just for a lot of people, it's hard to imagine what this stuff looks like until it becomes real. And to actually see the watershed as a party to the litigation, not the people in the watershed, but the watershed itself as an ecosystem, I think that rocked a lot of people's worlds, but actually begins to make it more acceptable, becomes to make it more legitimate and less crazy as more and more folks do it. And I think for more and more folks to do it, to talk to more and more judges about it, to actually drive constitutional amendments at the state level that recognize those rights of nature, I think it's all part of the beginning of a movement towards that community self-determination that I talked about earlier.
Well, and it's not possible to have a community that is even remotely sustainable if the real world is not given central consideration.
Yes, and the law has very little to do with the real world at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that one direction I was going to go is to say that something you've said many times is there has not been an environmental movement, and then have you talk about, actually, if you can do that really briefly, and then I'll go to the thing I wanted to say about what you just said.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most controversial things that we say is that there's never been an environmental movement in the United States because movements drive rights into the constitutional framework. So the suffragists, the abolitionists took entities that were not recognized as persons or being rights-bearing under the Constitution and actually changed that. And it took movements lasting 70, 100 years. Most of those movements aren't done yet and are only half finished, but the environmental movement has always treated ecosystems and nature as property and never as rights bearing. And so I think a real environmental movement is one that needs to focus on transforming nature from being property under the current system of law to actually possessing rights that are legally enforceable within the system of law that we have.
Which I think is incredibly important. And the other thing I was going to say is you said that, law doesn't have, I don't remember exactly what you said, but basically the law doesn't have a lot to do with reality, which, we see in so many different ways. One of the things that seems to be central to all of your work is we have this, we're told stories that we live in a democracy, and that if you ask people just off the top of their head if they believe we live in a democracy, most people would probably say sure. But if you ask these same people if the government takes better care of humans or corporations, every single one of them would say it takes better care of corporations. And so there seems to be this huge cognitive dissonance where on one level it's like, oh yes, the greatest democracy in the history of the planet. And then on another level, it's we all recognize that, it's the golden rule. The one with the gold makes the rules. And that basically those in power just squash us when they want what we've got.
Yes, and I think one of the reasons why we stopped working with major environmental groups and other organizations was because that belief in democracy was really implicit in what those groups do. So if you believe we live in a democratic system, then you engage in the type of activism that's been predetermined for you and prescripted for you. And then the outcome becomes the outcome, and you just have to live with it. But if you ask the people on the ground, whether we live in a democracy after they've encountered the corporation coming in to put a particular project in, and they've actually run up against the legal doctrines and the structure that puts them in a box when they attempt to stop something that's going to come in and damage them, that belief in democracy, that we have a democratic system, begins to erode. And so I think very much I would agree with you. There's a cognitive dissonance happening that most of the people that you ask would say we live in a democracy. The reason why we work almost exclusively with affected communities is because that's the place where it's happening the fastest. That people, when they come face to face with how the actual system works, and we're all so stupid about how the system works. It's not our fault that we're stupid. It's just the fact that we're treated as pawns in a system that whose script is written above our heads on a different playing board. And so these folks in communities are learning for the first time how the system actually functions. And in seeing how the system actually functions, which is divesting us almost completely of any authority to decide what happens in our own communities, that they are the first ones that are beginning to say, hey, this is not a democracy, and we actually have to create a democracy before we're able to stop these projects from happening. And so I think that's the most exciting part of this work in many ways, is that brain change is happening, that cultural change is shifting, but it only shifts when people see it play out in front of them on a particular issue that they care about. Otherwise, it just becomes this amorphous, pie in the sky, 30,000 foot thing, and is not about them in their own community on an issue that they care about.
I remember one time I interviewed you and you asked me to ask you a question. And the question you asked me to ask you beforehand was, was, so basically, if there's this commerce clause and if they're going to get squashed by the federal government, why are you having all these people in these communities put these laws forward? And part of your answer was, which I've just loved this answer, which is why I'm saying it all. Part of your answer was, because if you have people who believe we live in a democracy and you give them the tools to actually make democracy work, and then you give them these tools and then they get squashed by the government and by corporations, that's one of the best ways to radicalize people and to make revolutionary cadres right there. Because they thought we lived in a democracy, they took the tools, and then they got smashed.
Yeah, the shorthand we use internally is exhausting imagined remedies.
Oh, that's great.
So when people come to this, in their own community, they come to X project or whatever, they believe that they have certain remedies. And we assist them to exhaust those remedies. And because it's only after they're at the end of the line with nothing really left to lose, at least in terms of that activism, that they turn to something different. And the new activism we do is very scary. I mean, it's very scary to move outside the box. It's one thing to submit comments and give testimony at regulatory hearings, things that are legal and allowed for you to do. So they're in this box of allowable activism that we talk about. But when you move outside that box, man, the whole system crashes down on you because it's built to crash down on you. It's built to understand that your community is really just a dumping zone and that you can, flit around with the different corporate regulations when you're actually enforcing the corporation's own regulations against them. But as soon as you move outside of that and actually begin to work towards what you want rather than what you can get and what the planet actually needs in many ways, that the whole system crashes down. So every institution, whether it's the courts, the governor's office, which we've gotten into tangles with before in different places, the legislature that is destined to come in and on the side of the corporation, not on your side, that people begin to actually understand how the system functions and that it's really a corporate state. It's not a democracy at all. And I think for a revolution to occur, for a movement to build, that's a prerequisite. Movements don't build unless people see a need for the movement to change something. And unless you have a correct understanding and frame of the problem, then your solution falls short. And so until people begin to grapple with the fact that we don't have a democratic system operating, then we're not going to have any kind of real movement arise that pushes forward this different system that needs to come into being. Otherwise, we're all pretty screwed.
Well, we have about 5 minutes left, and I was going to ask you a wind-down question, and I'm going to ask you that in a second, but there's something else that occurs to me. And you and I have known each other for, 25 years now about?
Long time.
Yeah. And it occurs to me to ask you a question I have never before asked you, which, of course, is very dangerous. But the question is, if you can answer this very quickly so we can get on to what people can to do, how people can help, give me in, 1 minute – what are the best arguments for the other side against community rights? If not just a sort of corporate greed one, but their smartest argument.
Well, their smartest argument is usually entwined around NIMBY, that we can't just have everybody doing whatever they want in any small municipality, wherever. And when the NIMBY, they use the phrase patchwork of local laws or patchwork of regulations, that's bad for business. To have a patchwork of different laws that would cover companies, because then companies won't come in and do business within a particular state that has a patchwork of laws in place. So that's the phrase that they usually use. But when you get past that, and we've gotten past that, knocked them down in different places, the basic part of their argument is that this system that we have is responsible for liberty and progress and economic growth. That the system that we have, which is about centralized commerce authority in the federal government and for the states to have some role, but for the localities to have zero role, that communities should have zero role, that this system is responsible for progress and liberty and all the good things that we have in life. And that's the button that they've been pushing, ever since this work started 15 years ago. And it's the same button they push when any community decides to rise up and do something different. So they've gotten their lines down pat pretty well. the thing that's interfering with that PR at this point is the continued decline of the planet and the degradation of ecosystems and nature. Because as those become more apparent, it's tougher and tougher to defend the existing system and what it's doing to these places.
That's great. And the last question I want to ask for today, and we've got like 3 minutes left, is so somebody is listening to this and they live in either Decatur, Georgia, or they live in a small town in Nova Scotia, out of the country, point is. And in either case, they want to start to – they want to get involved and they like what you say. What should they do next?
Well, it depends on what's happening to that particular community. So if they're in Decatur, Georgia, and Nestle Corporation wants to come in and pump their aquifer dry, then that's one course of activism. They need to contact us, and then we would assist them to research what options are available to them in terms of lawmaking. We would help them draft a local law that works for the community. We would do presentations for them. We might do a democracy school, one of these two-day trainings that we have. But all those things are focused on essentially building a group of people that are capable of driving a change to the way that the law operates to then put them in a better position to fend off the corporate project that's coming in. So that's probably the easiest constituency is if they're in an affected community faced with one of these projects, they understand that the regulatory system is not going to help them. They want to do something different. Those are the folks that we look for, and they should contact us. The international piece isn't really a problem because we're now active in Nepal and Canada, Mexico, Ireland, Italy, a bunch of different places where we've begun to do work internationally with lawyers in other countries to actually research what options are available to them under the law and to try to replicate some of the work that's happened in the United States in those places. For people that just have a general interest in what we do, you know, the community rights movement, they may be in a state where we have a statewide organization in place that would welcome their involvement. So people that might want to get involved in pushing forward a constitutional amendment, for example. So in Colorado right now, people are gathering signatures for the proposed constitutional amendment that would legalize community rights within the state of Colorado. And so they need volunteers. They need people. They need people to do phone calls and to get out in the community and talk to people and give presentations and all those kinds of things. And in places where that's not happening at this point, the best thing for folks to do is give money. Also do local lawmaking on a preemptive scale. So if the community next door to you has been targeted for a factory farm, that not waiting for that factory farm to come to you, but actually make your community factory farm free or frack free or whatever, but operating in a preemptive sense before the imminent emergency comes in the door. And for that, we're situated to help them as well to do the same things that we would do in an affected community. But most of this organizing work comes down to that particular community's ability to fight off and fend off those unwanted projects that are proposed by someone else who are driven into those places.
Well, that's all great. And I would like to thank you for being on the program and for your work, of course. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Thomas Lindsay. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.